Hey everyone, welcome into another edition of the Woj Pod. And this is one that I have been anticipating, we've been talking about doing, and the timing is perfect. On the afternoon after the Warriors won the NBA championship, their fourth in 8 years. Nick, do I introduce you as a Warriors super fan? I don't know what the definition of super fan is, but one of the biggest Warrior fans I know, Nick Braun, the gifted actor who you probably almost certainly know from his role as Greg Hirsch in Succession, to name a few roles, but certainly it starts with super Warriors fan.
Oh yeah,
Nick Braun. How did we celebrate this championship last night? Because I know you weren't in Boston. I thought you might be there, but
I was hoping to be in Boston. I was going to be at Game 7 if there was a Game 7. Not that I was praying for a Game 7. I'm praying for the ship, obviously, but I wanted to be at one of these games. I mean, what a perfect showdown. I will say, when the Dubs were down 2-1, I had some fears. You know, things were feeling a little dicey if they didn't pull that Game 4 out. It could, you know, if they went down 3-1 on the Celtics team, I think it might have been over. But anyway, the right thing happened. I'm a massive, massive Warriors fan. I probably watched, you know, 78 out of 82 games this year. You know, I don't miss a game. I try my very best not to miss a game. I just love these guys. I think every one of them, they're just, I mean, I could break them all down. Maybe that's what we're going to do here for an hour, but also just excited. I mean, I didn't pop any bottles of my own last night. I'm sure they were up in Boston, but I, you know, it just felt really nice. You text all your fellow Warriors fans, you know, I'm texting you. I'm just, I don't know. It was nice. It felt really good. And it felt good to see Steph so emotional as well. That was he's a guy who never cracks in that way. So that was meaningful to watch.
Yeah, it really was. And you could feel it being around the court after the game and seeing the way the Warriors lingered on the court at TD Garden in Boston. And it wasn't for any other reason than you could just see them wanting to soak this one in. I don't remember this. With any of the other championships, even ones they won at home, they stayed out there and they took pictures and they hugged. And you could just see, and of course, Steph, you saw the emotion in the immediate moments. And then the rest of the night, it feels like their fans felt the same thing, that because you didn't know if this was coming again. You thought maybe nobody knew if the run was coming. And I don't think even this Golden State team, as confident as they were, you know, they needed Klay to come back and be himself again, and that happened. And I wasn't so sure this was a team during the season, I thought, that was supremely confident that they were a championship team, and they evolved into it again.
Yeah. I guess you don't really know until the playoffs start and you start getting, you know, banged around and you get the real test of, you know, of what it means this specific year to win this. You know, I mean, GP2 getting clocked in the head and it looking really bad. And they're like, yeah, but he could be back for finals if they go to the finals. And then he's back in the finals and he's so essential to, I think, the way they won these games. But yeah, back to what you said, I think that there was a real, like, sweet feeling for them. Like, it's always going to be good. You're always going to see Klay and Steph hyped, but I agree. They kind of reveled in it in a way that and Steph specifically felt unafraid to be hyped. And he's such a modest guy. You know, he's such a modest player. He never wants it's almost like he's always like thinking about the future. Yeah, this was good. You know, and a lot of NBA players do that. It's kind of the nature of the game. But it felt like he was just there celebrating, connecting with everybody, The hugs were like these deep, meaningful hugs. I mean, it's crazy how closely we're watching this as it's happening. And maybe in real life, you got an even better look. But I felt it through the screen too. It felt different. It felt really meaningful, this one.
So, Nick, you grew up between New York and Connecticut. Now, there might be some cynics who would say, okay, how do you become this big Warriors fan except for the way that, like, kids we knew in New York and Connecticut who became, like, big Cowboys fans when they were really good. They weren't Giants fans or Jets fans.
Mm-hmm.
When did you become a Warriors fan and why?
Well, so, yeah, I grew up in New York City in Connecticut. I, you know, was a fan of the 90s Knicks. We would go to those games. You know, big Knicks fan as a kid. And then my dad moved to LA. Me and my brother were huge, you know, Kobe fans in the Kobe heyday. And then I lived in LA and, you know, I've been acting since I was a kid, just to give a little background. So I started acting at 6, 7 years old. I did my first movie at 11 years old. And I always had my eyes set on moving to LA and doing it out there. So I went to college out there. And I didn't get into the Clippers too much or the Lakers too much once I was there. And my brother, my little brother, Chris, went to USF. And so I would go up there all the time. This is from like 2008 on. And, you know, I was up there all the time. Obviously people are getting into the Warriors, but honestly, it was early days, like the first couple years of Steph being on the team. My brother said he went to a game and he paid $4 and sat in like the empty nosebleeds in 2010 or something, 9 or 10. And then there was a moment in my career where I'd done a bunch of movies that I thought were going to hit big, or, you know, they would be this sort of big momentum swing that you're thinking, all right, like finally I got these big studio movies, and they just didn't land as most movies don't, you know, it's so hard for things to do really well. And I kind of just got frustrated with the business and being an actor, and so much, there's just so many factors outside of your control that basically like dictate your career. And I've always loved making music. And so my brother's a musician, and I moved up to San Francisco and we started making music, and he was teaching me how to produce, and we were making stuff, living in his apartment together. And, you know, this is probably 2015, 2016. We live in the inner Richmond on 21st and Geary, and, you know, just got hooked. Like we would, you know, sit around in his kitchen, laptop on the table, watching Warriors games. And so, you know, we grew our obsession together around that time. And then I got Succession, you know, late 2016. And that was sort of the beginning of me moving away from San Francisco. Sorry, long story to get to it, but I think, you know, worth telling.
No, and it's this Warrior team and this run, it was such an easy team, I think, for people to fall in love with. And you talked like those early years with Steph, and he had the ankle injuries. And mm-hmm. I remember reporting on his 4-year, $44 million extension. And I remember that night people saying, I think they overpaid for him. I think they're going to regret that extension. And it was a kind of a compromise deal right at the deadline, that rookie extension deadline. And then all of a sudden by the end of that deal, I remember sitting with Steph, doing it. It was at Emerson College where my daughter just graduated from. We were in the gym there. And I remember I wanted to ask him about, now he'd become an MVP in the last year of that deal, or at the end of it last year, second to last year, when he'd become an all NBA player, then an MVP. There were times he was the lowest paid Warrior player on the court. There would be a 5-man group that he was the lowest paid player. And if it ever entered his mind, he was at that time was, he had signed the contract. You can't change the contract in the NBA. They don't tear it up. And that was interesting to me that he was like, of course I've thought about it, but I don't complain about it. And there's some guys who would, and they would talk about it all the time. And the Warrior guys, front office, teammates, no one had ever heard him once even acknowledge it. It was like, hey, it's a contract I signed. It was, and of course he was on his way to his max, next max deal, but the world around that team changed, right, Nick, so quickly, where they went from, you know, an interesting young team to this perennial champ, you know, to a champion, to the Kevin Durant years. He leaves, and obviously they've climbed that mountain again after, you know, 2 years ago winning 15 games, and it's and they're built to, as I'm sure you and your Warrior friends and you're thinking about it, they're built to keep doing this. The Steph and Clay and Wiggins, who I'm sure they're going to re-sign. I'm confident they'll re-sign. There's no, why would he ever leave there? And they're willing to pay and go into even deeper in luxury tax. This thing's going to go on.
It feels really strong. It does feel strong. I mean, I was thinking about it today. The bench that didn't even get to play really in these finals, you know, Kuminga, Moody, Juan Toscano, Bielitsa got some time, but those guys are really good. And, you know, especially Kuminga. Kuminga feels like kind of the future of the franchise. He's the next, you know, Jordan Poole, who's you know, who came in and became kind of a defining part of the team this year, obviously. GP2, who, you know, I've talked to you about a bunch of times. I feel like he's the young Iggy. It's like they're just breeding a new crop of similar, like, incredibly talented, but, you know, well-fostered guys. You know, Steve, I don't know what he does, but he has the, you know, the secret sauce to just empower these guys, find their identity, bring it up, and they're all so confident when they hit the court from play, you know, the first play, they jump on, boom, they're in it, they're helpful. And so I agree. It's, things are looking really good. And it's interesting to watch Steph's game morph and Clay. I mean, you know, Steph used to be this kind of lankier, kind of slipperier kind of guy. Now he's a bigger kind of mass on the court, but he's still so sneaky. And he, you know, like in that play with Horford, as he sort of races him to the hoop, he always knows how to get his shoulder, you know, into somebody and basically beat him to the hoop. And he, and you know, I was going to ask you about this actually, because obviously for a coach, it's like, yeah, Steph Curry. Okay, how do we defend Steph Curry? And all these coaches try to come up with their strategies and whatnot. But is he just a, sort of an undefendable person? Because it looks like he'll just sort of dance. He'll dance with you, you know, a couple moves. Maybe it's 5-6 moves. Maybe he'll drop the ball. It's a mistake. Then he makes something beautiful happen out of the mistake. I mean, he's willing to fail. He goes and he gets blocked and he goes, you know, plenty of turnovers and stuff. But at the end of the day, like he's got the cheat codes. So what do these coaches say that they tried and that failed? Or, you know, it must be a lengthy, lengthy discussion going into a series. What are we going to do about him? And once again, you know, the Celtics more specifically couldn't do it.
Yeah, I mean, you think of you, and you talked about Steph's evolution. He got physically stronger over time. He could take contact better, play through contact. He's an underrated finisher at the rim, just a great ability in the paint to finish with contact, but also finish with that floater, and an incredible passer. And he can pass off of either hand. And then getting Clay back when, you know, teams can load up on you when you don't have, you know, when you have that kind of talent around you, it's easier to load up on one player. And Clay getting back and playing again at a high level. And I know he was playing with a pretty sprained ankle last night, playing through injury. I know from game 5 when he kind of tweaked it. And he's just so, you know, he redefined what a good shot was. He redefined where you have to defend the player on the court, which is literally – when he crosses midcourt, you've got to be defending him. He extended defense. And so all of those factors. And yeah, you saw in this series, the whole key to this thing, and they all knew it, no matter bringing in Wiggins, the development of Jordan Poole, which has been really, he's been a revelation, but getting Clay back at a high level, I think, was, they all felt, we've got to be able to do that to win again. And certainly he's got a big contract and you're not going to move that if he's not able to play it at a high level again. And he did. And him coming back played, and he's such a part of the core and the emotional core of that team, and Draymond Green and what he's made. It's just a group that fits together. And it was interesting. I think they broke the record, I think, for trio playoff victories of Ginobili, Tim Duncan, and Tony Parker. And in their own way, they're very different. But Steve Kerr certainly likes to compare Steph to Tim Duncan. But there's just such a – Steph doesn't get enough credit for who he is, how he leads, how he handled the whole Kevin Durant thing. Durant coming, Durant leaving, and winning in between there. He allowed that franchise to just keep going, and he allows them to keep going. And, you know, Duncan, he doesn't say a lot. And Duncan was the same way. You talk about, like, in San Antonio, people would always say that people kind of thought it was this utopia in the NBA, and they talk about Spurs culture the way they do Golden State. And, you know, the people in San Antonio would always tell you, it's not like we didn't have issues in the locker room. It's not like things didn't present themselves that were problems, but Tim Duncan always took care of it within the walls of the locker room. It didn't always get out. And I think Steph's ability to lead the group, command respect, handle issues that come up, because they do everywhere, people don't see it. It's not being on the court. And Draymond's leadership is different. You can see it. You can see him. Mm-hmm. He's different. And Steph has always allowed Draymond to be who Draymond is. And the team needed that. And they need what Steph. It's just the you talk about it with Steve Kerr, the chemistry of it. And I think Steve's experiences with the Bulls, with Phil Jackson and Michael, with the Spurs and the years he spent there, he was so perfectly qualified as a guy who had never coached before to come in and be the right guy for that team at the right time. And now one of the great coaches in history, obviously, with his fourth championship as a head coach.
Yeah, it's hard to pin it on one thing. I guess you have several coaches on the team. It's probably the same on every team in a way, but you got Iguodala over there grabbing GP2. You got Steph supporting the guys, sort of, you can, you know, not as loudly as you're saying as Draymond. You got Steve making good calls. I mean, what do you think was a moment where Steve made a call that only Steve would call? Like, I mean, we saw that he pulled Draymond in that game where Draymond was kind of, losing it. But when you see Steve do something, you're like, ah, there it is. There's the coaching greatness.
I think you mentioned it with Draymond, is knowing how to coaching Draymond and coaching when he had to coach through the Draymond Kevin Durant issues and how that impacted the team. There was a lot that had to be dealt with. And, you know, I know earlier in his tenure as head coach, he'd call Tom Izzo a lot more for advice, because Tom Izzo, you know, it's funny, a lot of guys in the NBA calling the college coach doesn't, you know him better than a college coach did, because they were only there for 5 or 6 months as a one-and-done freshman. Draymond played 4 years of college basketball. He's the rare NBA All-Star who was a four-year player. Tom Izzo really knows how to coach him, because he coached him. I mean, they were close, and they had ups and downs. It wasn't just a one Big Ten season partnership. And so I do think how Steve handles people is really important. Bob Myers, their GM, all of them together, it's just there's a remarkable the staying power that group has had, and and an owner who's willing, ownership who's willing to spend. I mean, they're luxury tax. They benefit, Nick, from let's say this offseason, Jordan Poole is up for his rookie extension. Let's say he gets 25, 26, 27 million a year, whatever it's going to be. Most other teams would say, okay, if we're going to pay Jordan Poole, we can't keep Draymond Green. We can't pay him too, or we can't keep Klay Thompson or Wiggins, whoever it is. We can't have all four of those guys. Maybe we can't re-sign Looney. Golden State's willing 2 years from now, if they keep this group together and they seem determined to, they're looking at like a $475 million payroll, $275 million luxury tax. There aren't many teams able or willing to do that, but it's within the rules. They have an owner who wants to win, who has a very profitable new building, and so they can keep. They don't have to make maybe some of the hard decisions others do, but you're the one who drafted Jordan Poole in the 20s and developed him.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nick, one thing I want to ask you. You talked about your career, your acting career, changing with Succession in the mid-2015-16, and the Warriors now are at an apex. How did those two go hand in hand in your life? Because like I said, you're watching Warrior games every night, and now all of a sudden your career's going in a new place. I mean, this Succession playing Gregory Hirsch. It changed your life. Mm-hmm.
It definitely did. It's the greatest thing that's happened in my career, hands down. It's funny you sort of pair the two together, because it's going to sound really stupid, and I've never said this, but we're doing a basketball podcast. So, sometimes this is going to sound very dumb possibly, but there are these like buzzer beater times on set. That's like, we have one more take and the sun is setting and it's about to go down and the light is perfect and we have 100 background and they're all here. And if we have to go 10 more minutes, we have to pay them all $500 bucks more. There are these like times as an actor where you have to nail it. And I do think of those times as like my Steph Curry buzzer beater times. And because I'm like, I consider myself in the this all might just be cringy and feel free to tell me if so, but I'm not an athlete. I played some tennis, I played some golf, I played some I'm 6'7", so I obviously played some basketball, but I hate running. And so I'm in this show and it's in the big leagues. I consider it like, it's like we're in the NBA of TV, and I'm on a f-ing awesome team with a group of, it's like, we're trying to win the ship. We're trying to be the best. We're trying to make the best possible show. The amount of talent I'm around in every capacity, if you want to call Jesse Armstrong our Steve Kerr, sure. We can do all the parallels, because it's true and it's real. And when you're filming, there is this kind of pressurized environment. Like, we have to shoot this today. We are paying $100,000 for this hotel room only for tonight. We will never come back here. We must get it and it must be good or else it gets cut from the show. And I find that I see every scene as an opportunity for something really special to happen, for something really great. And because the writing is so good, I'm always like, we gotta get this, because this could be amazing. People need to see this. We need to nail this. So anyway, that is in my head a lot. I'm like, hit the three, baby. Come on.
No, it the parallels absolutely. And it makes perfect sense, because like you said, it is a pressurized environment, and the talent, that's the thing, Nick, the talent you are around on that show. I mean, it is, the characters, it's my favorite show. I cannot wait for season four. I am fascinated. Cousin Greg in the final episode, you make this pact with Tom Wamscams. You're going to the dark side. Like, it feels like Greg is going to change. Something changed there. We'll talk about that. But that group of actors you are with, I wonder when you first read the script and you were talking about playing Greg Hirsch, would you have imagined, because he's the one character who's not really, you're trying to figure out whether he's really a Roy or not. He's not part of the Roy, the legacy Roys. He's a cousin. He's an interloper. And when you're reading that script and you're seeing these characters and you're going to work with Brian Cox and you're going to work with Jeremy Strong, would you have imagined that people would, after season three, there are lots of people who say, Cousin Greg, Nick Braun is my favorite character on that show. Did it feel like it would even be possible with who you were playing with and who you're playing with?
I mean, I don't really think, I wasn't like, I'm not like intimidated by it. Like, you know, I'm so excited. I'm like, I get to look Brian Cox in the eye and see what he does as an actor. How, you know, it's like, you get to step in front of these artists and they're going to give you some and you're going to give them some and you're going to see how it bounces off each other. So it's more exciting than anything. I wasn't like, I hope this works. I kind of think I understood how Greg fit into the whole pie. It's like, yeah, you have this substantial patriarch, Brian Cox. You have the great sort of, you know, but sort of sad character of Kendall, you know, all the sibling dynamics, but I kind of knew where Greg fit in and where he and Tom and all their, you know, their stuff fits in. I will say the first season when Matthew and I were filming these scenes and it was really funny. And at the table reads, it's like, we're cracking up. Everybody's laughing. And then it goes into a Brian Cox, Jeremy Strong, you know, Kieran Culkin scene that's fully loaded and heavy and has all these sort of, you know, whatever, all the stuff that part of the show entails. I was like, are these scenes all going to get cut? Is the Tom and Greg thing not going to work? How do we fit into the rest of this show? And I don't know. You hope not, but Jesse, our writer and his writing team, I guess they just figured out like it needs that. But yeah, going back to the team, I do feel like I'm with a group that will be hard to beat. It'll be hard to go on to things and the camaraderie at this point, but really the best acting comes out of trust and being relaxed. And, you know, I think we all just like really, we love the way we work. We're all fans of each other. And, you know, that's why you see the Warriors together for 10, 11 years and that keeps working, keeps clicking. And we're going on year six since we shot the pilot. So we're a tight group.
Nick, how do you get back into you've evolved from the first day you showed up on set and started as Cousin Greg. The character has evolved. You've evolved as a person. And then you had the pandemic and you get these long breaks. You maybe get some longer breaks in between. How do you get back into that character? Is it ever a challenge?
Yeah, I think it definitely is a daunting thing. Like, okay, am I going to be able to do this again? You know, approaching season two was a bit of that, but the show hadn't become a thing after season one. It didn't have the kind of awareness yet. And then after season two, we started to kind of get on people's radars and won some awards and things. And so the pressure was built, and then the pandemic hit and it was an extra year of waiting to shoot. And so day one of season three, in a full plastic shield and thick mask, and everybody's in masks. I don't even know if these are the same crew members as the last season. I don't even really know who's here. I'm kind of just stepping on and doing Succession, I guess. You know, then we take the masks off the actors, and it's like, okay, all right, here we are. We're doing it. And, you know, you put the suit on and you do the hair the right way, and you get I kind of work on like a certain posture and a voice and a, you know, a kind of a darty eye, and there's sort of, I don't know, there's a few things that kind of click in once I start reading these lines. And I don't know, you stand in the mirror and get the tie length right, you know, and a lot of those things help. You put the right dress shoes on. You know, if I put on Prada shoes, it doesn't feel like Greg. If I put on, you know, some worn out, you know, Brooks Brothers dress shoes that felt like I've had them for 10 years, like that's more Greg. So, stuff like that, and you kind of sink back in. But until you're shooting, it's like, am I gonna do this again? Holy, I hope so.
Nick, the congressional testimony scene, Jesse Armstrong, sort of prepared you in a little different way. He kind of threw the dialogue at you a little bit last minute, different than maybe you might have another scene. How, because I think it's certainly in season three, I think it's one that was memorable, and mm-hmm. you testify, you come back into that waiting, that conference room with the rest of the Roys, and it's probably as viscerally angry as anyone's ever seen you. I mean, you tell Tom Watt, like I'm going to prison for that guy. Like, I can't believe I just turned down, I'm trying to remember, $250 million so I can go to prison for that asshole, right? And Logan shooed you out of the room. But what was the prep like for that scene in the courtroom where you're trying to, you know, after you saw Tom go in and just get obliterated and you know you're going into the blender there?
So we get our scripts one at a time. And so I don't know, especially in that season, I didn't know what was coming. You know, I didn't know what was coming until it got to me, until I read the script. And so we're shooting episode 9, I believe that is. And we had yet to table read 10. Table reads, like, we get the script the night before. This is the first time anybody gets it. It's the night before the table read. And we sit around a table and we hear it and hear what each other are going to do. And we might never again, unless we're in the scene with those people. So always very exciting, but we had not gotten script 10 yet. And so we're in 9, we're filming that stuff. We filmed the scene where I'm behind Tom and pass him the note about, or maybe that got cut, but there's a moment where he's accused by the congressional, you know, by the senators, and I'm right behind him sort of trying to hold in my holy expression. And I think at the end of that day, Jesse, our creator, had come up, he came up to me and he said, "Hey, Nick, can I grab you for a second?" So we have a scene at the beginning of 10, which is you in Congress. And having to defend yourself after that scene where your name has been revealed in the how many tomlets, what is it? How many
eggs does it take to break a tomlet? No.
How many Gregs does it take to break? No, how many? I should know this.
It's on t-shirts. It's on t-shirts.
On the street. Yeah, what? How do I not know this? But he goes, "Can I show you this scene? And if we can, we want to shoot it tomorrow morning." And this is like 9 p.m. and we would be back in 12 hours. And so he shows it to me. It's obviously super funny, but it's like 6 pages actually. So it's a full rebuttal to whatever the senators are asking me, and it goes through a bunch of stuff and a bunch of the things Tom has done that are horrible that I basically have to sort of, you know, defend for him. And obviously there's the stuff that's in the scene, but a lot of it got cut. Either way, it was very exciting and felt completely correct to get thrown these pages last minute and learn them sort of, you know, manically the night before, and then go in as Greg and try to, you know, sit in front of Congress and somehow, you know, get out alive. And I really like that. I like preparing shortly before I shoot a scene, because I don't want to plan too much. I need to know the lines perfectly, but I love to just let it go where it goes emotionally, and, you know, depending on what the other actor's doing. And I leave a lot of room for just, you know, the craziness of the moment, or some background person bumping into me and me reacting to it, or, you know, Dan just said, you can't make a Tom without breaking a few Gregs. That's it. There it is. Got to remember that. But anyway, so that's the way I like to work, and it fit right in. And I love that Jesse trusted me to learn it the night before. That was a very fun one.
There was another one a little like that, and we had talked about this before. The Logan Roy testimonial, when he goes back to Ireland, and he has, you know, that big in his hometown, and he goes back, and Kendall does his ode to the OG, does his ode to Logan, does the rap. And when you watch the reactions of your colleagues, like, people were legitimately, they had not seen him do it. You were the only one who had heard him singing the rap, doing it. I think Karen Culkin, his siblings on the show, they hadn't, but there was a reason, right? Jeremy Strong had a reason that you should be familiar with it, right? Which I thought was really interesting, and mm-hmm. and how you guys saw the characters.
Well, Kendall has given Greg an apartment in the same building as him. He's a few floors below, and but in a great spot. So he gives him that apartment, and Jeremy and I thought that Kendall would have rehearsed this rap in front of Greg and gotten notes from Greg, and that would have been a fun bro moment for them. I don't think Kendall would have trusted that performance with anyone else. And right before Jeremy performed it, you know, and we filmed it, he was, you know, he brought me into his trailer and he showed me the rap, and he was doing it, you know, over and over. And I was, you know, we were jumping around his trailer, shaking it, like, and everybody was like, what the hell is going on down there? And we were just so hyped. I was like, hell yeah, dude. And he was like, you got to come up with me. And I was like, yeah. He's like, dude, Greg should be on stage with me. You got to come up. And so he tried to get me on stage with him for this rap to be, you know, like his hype man. And I think luckily that idea got shot down, but
it worked with you nodding. You were nodding and singing the words along, and it there was that familiarity. It was different than everybody else who just had shock on their face.
Yes. Yeah. That was enough alone to be like, why does Greg know this? And why is this not a shock to him? But that was really fun. I mean, that's working with Jeremy. You know, he's open to any of it. And man, he's just so good. That was such a fun moment. And he took it as seriously as you can take a performance. Like, that was not funny for him. That was not a joke rap. He was rehearsing and pacing beforehand because he, as Kendall, wanted to do a great job.
I have it on my playlist. I have it on my playlist. I listen to it.
It's good.
It's good. It's good. It's great.
It's a banger. Yeah, he can rap. And then he sings in season three in his the opening scene of his birthday episode.
Billy Joel. Yeah.
Great singer. I mean, let it out. Let it out, man.
Nick, when did you... You've been acting all of your adult life and much of your childhood, and you're recognized as an actor. It wasn't like what Succession wasn't the first time people recognized you on the street, but something changed, right? Like, and was it in season three where all of a sudden people are reacting to you in a way that you've not experienced? You've lived in LA, you've been in New York, you probably walked fairly anonymously through the streets. I don't imagine that happens anymore. I don't think it happens anymore. I've been with you enough places to know it does not happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't happen anymore. It did change. I guess I would say after season two, I think it changed for everybody on the show. Especially cause I live in New York and few of us live in New York, few in London. You know, these are cities that watch it and love it. So, you know, living here, it's different. It's great. You know, the goal of working as an actor, making movies and television and doing this medium is like, is people having enjoyment, like loving a story, loving characters. And so, you know, the recognizing thing it means we've done a good job. And for people to love Greg and quote this Tomlitz thing that I can't even quote myself, you know, like that's the best. And I'd rather be in something that makes people feel like that and learn the lines and play back the scenes and rewatch the season multiple times, which people do. Like that's, you know, that's an amazing thing. So I'm pretty grateful for it, even though it's, yeah, life does change. You have to do things a bit differently, but it's good.
Your life as an NBA going to games changed. You went from like you and your brother are going to buy $5 tickets in Oakland to go to a game to now you go to Staples or no, excuse me. It's not Staples. It is crypto.com arena. When you go to LA Live, right now, like you're in celebrity seat, you call, you get tickets. That's for an NBA fan. Like when you think of the perks, like that's gotta be of all the things that came with Succession. You can sit wherever you want at an NBA game now.
That's probably the greatest gift of Succession, you know? Sitting on the wood, come on. Yeah, I don't
except the Nets Celtics. Except the next Nets Celtics playoff series. I know you ran into some trouble there.
Yeah, that wasn't great. That wasn't great because I'm not a Celtics fan. I'm not even a Nets fan, but my best buddy Chris Mintz-Blass loves the Celtics. I'm from New York. I was like, I'm gonna go support him, but also not cheer for the Celtics because I'm a Warriors fan and we're sitting at the Nets bench. So it was a tricky line to walk there. But I would say one of the greatest moments, honestly, in life, but definitely as an NBA, a lover of the game. At the end of that game, I think it was game three of that series, and the Nets are down by a few points. It's maybe like 4 or 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter. Chris and I are sitting at one of these like, kind of tables, like a scorer's table that's not being used. Also where they keep all the lotions and creams and things. So guys are always coming over and moisturizing their hands and shaking powders and stuff right in front of us. That's also sort of a weird part. But towards the end of the game, Kyrie and KD sit on this table, basically, you know, in front of us, and KD is in the middle and I'm kind of on the right side of this scorer's table. And I kind of lean over like, I'm tired too, you know, what a tough game, man. Yeah. It's been exhausting sitting here and watching. So I kind of lean over, KD's sitting there. They're trying to figure out how to get out of the hole. And he looks over at me and I look at him. We give each other a nod. He puts his pound out, he puts his fist out. I put mine out and we have a silent bro moment where I hope what was conveyed through my eyes was, you're one of the greatest alive. You're, you know, I was trying to affirm him in a moment of how the f- are we going to win this game? But that was one of the coolest things ever. And Chris was basically like directly behind Katie, and he, and after Katie and I pound, I look at Chris and he's staring at me. He goes, "What the f- just happened?" And I was like, "Dude, I don't know. It just happened. It was magic." He's like, "How did you?" I looked up and you're pounding KD. They're losing the game. What are you doing? It was just, that was a very special moment.
And your way of thanking him for the two Warrior championships, all of that in that moment,
yep.
I imagine.
Yep. Totally. So many hours of watching him and loving the way he played in Golden State. You know, what an incredible player still to watch. I'm such a big fan. So yeah, that was good. That was a good one.
Nick, beyond the acting and these long NBA seasons, which are grueling for you, now we've got an off season, and which probably makes, it's probably helpful now that you'll go, and I know you'll start filming here later this year for season 4.
Actually, a couple weeks.
Oh,
and yeah, end of June we're starting season 4. Yeah.
But you're doing your own. You're developing. You've got a couple things in the hopper. One of them, which was just announced maybe a couple months ago, HBO is developing an indie music, kind of like it from the indie music scene of the 2000s. That you're developing, writing, working on, that's coming down the road. And then you're doing more writing. Like that's a bigger part of your career right now.
Yeah, it is. It is. I want to make things, you know, I want to create things and direct. And I've been so inspired by being on Succession and, you know, learning from the you know, Jesse, the producers, the directors, just the way that show is made is, it's just incredible. And I think I want to, I want to make something. And so I've got a few projects that I'm writing, and yeah, one of them is this show for HBO, a half hour, for HBO about this indie band, you know, 2005, grinding it out on the road, you know, living in their van and struggling to make enough money to eat the gas station food and, you know, peeing in jugs and just the sort of disgusting life, you know, of living on the road and playing music and trying to make it happen. And so it's about one band. And I think it's been amazing to meet people from that era, talk about it, research it. You know, we'll be creating music for this band. Someone will help us sort of invent a band from 2005 and maybe emulate Arcade Fire or, you know, Modest Mouse. We feel like maybe there's some Modest Mouse in there. There might be a little Strokesy. So there's so many aspects that are just really cool. And it's like a show on the road. It's like, you know, it's going to feel cinematic. We're going to go into parts of America that don't often get seen. So that one's really exciting. And the other thing I'm writing is a film that I will direct and star in. And that is super exciting. I mean, I just want to keep evolving, keep trying new things. Writing is not something I've been doing for more than a few years, but it's, you know, I think it's so helped by reading basically the best scripts I've ever read in Succession and going from here, you know, once at some point, you know, I won't be able to be Greg anymore. And so I'm enjoying trying to figure out what to do next and how to keep shape shifting.
Nick, this has been awesome. We've been looking forward to doing this. I'm excited. I know you're going to go into, like you said, a couple weeks, you're headed into filming for season 4 of Succession. I know we'll be talking some, probably a little free agency in early July. See if some of those Warrior extensions can get done, right? Jordan Poole, Andrew Wiggins, they got time on those. They got plenty of time to get those done. Kevon Looney, you got to keep him. Get James Wiseman healthy this summer.
And yeah, what do you hear about James Wiseman?
I hear that he should be in summer league. He should be playing there. He hasn't played very many games. Think about that. How many teams could have the second pick in the draft, really get nothing out of him for 2 years, and no one's talking about it. You're not missing it on the floor. He's going to feel like found money when he starts to contribute and play, and he's a very talented player. I think he's determined to get back on the court, and he's still so young. There's a lot of upside there. So I think sometimes you forget he's there, and you think of, and you talked about it, Kuminga and Moody and Wiseman. And, I think last year there was, some thought, and the Warriors ultimately pushed back on this, which was they would package these young guys to go get another, established veteran player. They don't need to. Jordan Poole's evolved and become that. And so they're in great shape, and they have these like two parallel, you've got the championship group, and then you've got this younger group coming up can bridge a future. Very few teams, almost nobody can do what they're doing and have two sort of eras that you can evolve into as Steph and Clay and Draymond, eventually, head into the sunset. So it's a good time to be a Warriors fan.
I love it, man. I'm addicted to it. I love that team. I hope to meet those guys someday. I don't know.
I think
it's coming. I won't know where to start,
it's not like being on Entourage where you could get guys cameos. You can't do it on Succession. Like the Entourage years, right? They could get, like, if they were a Lamar Odom fan, they could get him in there. They got Brady in there, right? But like, that's not happening. It's not happening.
No, I mean, unless Greg gets courtside seats, his first courtside seats and spills a drink onto the floor, injures one of the players, Steph gets injured, slips on it, and then maybe they become best friends through Steph's rehab. That's a kind of a cool, huge arc for Steph Curry.
HBO did do that with Larry David and Shaq. Remember, he brought the Seinfeld episodes to the hospital, Shaq like Seinfeld, and Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah. He tripped Shaq courtside at a Laker game. Shaq had knee surgery. Larry got booed out of Staples. It's exactly how you would imagine.
Oh, my God. I just said that storyline. Wow. Maybe I've seen it and I forgot. I thought I was coming up with an original idea, but that's great.
Nick, thank you for doing this. This is a lot of fun. I know we'll talk again soon, and good luck with filming. Season 4 of Succession is coming, everybody.
Thanks, Woj. Been so great, man. Thanks for inviting me, and I'll talk basketball with you endlessly. So thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Woj Pod. A big thank you to my guest today, Nick Braun. Be sure to listen to new and archived episodes of the Woj Pod wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to also listen to The Low Post with Zach Lowe, The Hoop Collective with Brian Windhorst, and the Adam Schefter podcast with Adam Schefter. We'll catch you next time.